Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Are you doing more sharing these days? Well, in a virtual sense, most of us would probably answer yes. We're sharing political petitions, photos shot with our mobile phones, and of course, cute cat stuff. But what about sharing in the real world? Are you doing more of that? Well, as a society, the answer again is yes. Whether bike sharing, which is rolling out in 500 cities, car sharing, even Hertz is getting into the game, or apartment sharing through services like Airbnb, habits and practices of simpler times like swapping, trading, renting, sharing, bartering have been reinvented through real-time technologies and peer-to-peer networks to make sharing more efficient and affordable than buying new things. An article in Forbes, you know, a capitalist magazine if ever there was one, notes, quote, "A few dozen square feet in a driveway can now produce income via Parking Panda. A pooch-friendly room in your house is suddenly a pet penthouse via Dog Vacay. On Snapgoods, a drill lying fallow in a garage can become a $10 a day income source from a homeowner who just needs to put up some quick drywall. On Liquid, an unused bicycle becomes a way for a traveler to cheaply get around while visiting town for $20 a day." And according to another fairly conservative magazine, The Economist, quote, "Occasional renting is cheaper than buying something outright or renting from a traditional provider such as a hotel or a car rental firm. The internet makes it cheaper and easier than ever to aggregate supply and demand. Smartphones with maps and satellite positioning can find a nearby room to rent or a car to borrow, and online social networks and recommendation systems help establish trust. Internet payment systems can handle the billing." So are we entering an age where we value services more than products and access more than ownership? Whether driven by economic hard times or technological innovation, something's going on here. And I'm going to be talking about it for the next hour with April Rinn, Chief Strategy Officer of the Collaborative Lab. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I'm out to find out how. In addition to her work promoting sharing, April Rinna is the director of Water Credit at water.org, which puts microfinance tools to use in the water and sanitation sector throughout the developing world. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School, the Fletcher School, and Emory University, and is a Fulbright scholar. She serves on the board of the World Wide Web Foundation and is a member of the Relationship Economy Expedition, REX. Welcome, April, to Free Forum.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
And let me double-check the pronunciation of your last name because I realized I'd never heard it spoken.
That's okay. It's Rinnie.
Rinnie. Okay, April Rinnie. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I just did a quick bit of bio, but could you tell us in your own words a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today? Feeling free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. So trying to keep this brief, but at the same time trying to connect lots of dots that really create a composite picture, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It probably goes back to even as a child, where I was raised traveling constantly with a view that the world was bigger than my own backyard, and constantly with this knowledge, which I learned later that I shouldn't take for granted, that my parents instilled in me the fact that because I was a girl and I was lucky enough to go to school, that made me really, really lucky. And so as a result of that, and I thought that's what all children learned, I now know that's not necessarily the case. But where it led was for my parents also to say that because I had been fortunate enough to go to school, and whereas a lot of children in the world don't have that opportunity, that I had an obligation to give back. And they said, you know, you can give back in a lot of different ways. You can teach, volunteer, you can do anything. But if you think that your career is about you, you've got it wrong. Your career is about some kind of, I guess you could say, service or contribution to the greater community. So I kind of set forth and went to college and grad school and traveled for a bunch and so forth with that in the back of my mind. And I think I've always been somebody who's looking for ways to do things differently, ways to see the world in an upside-down fashion, and ways to be positively disruptive. And so early in my career, that led me to microfinance. And that was a case in which I had spent 4 years traveling, mostly in the developing world with a backpack and a shoestring budget, and really on my own, trying to figure out how as much of the world lived as I could. So that led me to spend lots of time in public plazas and in the developing world and just chatting with normal people, many of whom I now know to be microfinance clients, but at the time I didn't even know that word. But it led me to this sort of aha moment, because it was right at this time that microfinance was starting to gain some traction, but it was well before the Nobel Peace Prize or anything like that. And so I gravitated towards this because I was interested in economics, interested in international development, and interested in making a contribution. And long story short, that took off with great zest in the coming years. And so I was able to get a lot of professional exposure and credibility, really serving the microfinance community, not just from a financial perspective, though, but also from a legal perspective. And part of the reason why I went to law school and did a joint degree was because I was very interested in the intersection between law and finance and in the context of development. And where that led me also over the years was to work with governments in the developing world around how to create an enabling environment. So laws, policies, the rules of the game, and the behavior change to really promote this new kind of activity at the time, microfinance, this new way of creating value and providing necessary goods and services to the unbanked and to those people that weren't, you know, they're certainly not stupid. They're certainly not without value. The fact is they don't have typical assets, but that to say that they're not bankable is really false. So spent time doing that, really enjoyed it because we were making a very tangible difference in terms of developing some of the legal and regulatory infrastructure to have massive change in the developing world, which now we know also goes back to the developed world, and there's microfinance even here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That led me then to be looking, a lot of people would call me a bumblebee. I love to cross-pollinate ideas, sectors, ways of thinking about the world. That time spent in microfinance led me to realize that just because somebody has a loan to run a small business, and that's what typical microfinance loans are, doesn't necessarily mean that they have other essential goods and services in their life. So you'll often find microfinance clients who still can't afford to send the children to school, or still don't have clean water in their homes, or sanitation, or access to energy. So started looking around, like, well, what else is going on here that I need to, again, cross-pollinate? And water and sanitation came to the fore, and that's how I ended up at water.org and leading Water Credit. That was where I was playing the bridge between financial innovation and then water and sanitation, which historically has not had any kind of financial innovation to its detriment. So that was really interesting. And then that in turn led me separately. It's sort of a step factor in terms of the way I was looking at the world.
That's April Rennie, and she is the Chief Strategy Officer for the Collaborative Lab, and she's the Director of Water Credit at water.org. And we're talking about, over the course of this hour, the growing trend of sharing rather than buying. And you can learn more at, I'll give you a couple of websites. One is two words put together, collaborative consumption. One word, collaborativeconsumption.com or shareable.net. Shareable, one word, .net. One more time, as you're talking about what you do at water.org, how does microfinance adapt to the water world or the water arena or space?
Right. Well, first I need to provide a caveat that I am no longer at water.org.
Oh.
I left in order to actually be at Collaborative Lab full on. There was a transition period, which wrapped up earlier this year, but we probably want to get that right as well.
Sure.
Continue to be a big fan, continue to think it's a great thing, but I know that my overarching passion really is in the sharing economy,
mm-hmm.
and so have jumped that full force. So in terms of the linkage between water and microfinance, just a quick snapshot there, a story is probably in order. And think about it this way. You're a person living in an urban slum, one of many in the developing world. You don't have access, you don't have a tap in your house. And you know that there is a water main, let's say, you know, a couple blocks away. And to hook up to that would cost you about $100, maybe $200, depending on the country you live in. If you're a poor person living on $2 a day, $4 a day, I can assure you that you don't have $100 just lying around. But I can also assure you that if you don't have water in your home, you or some member of your family is typically spending on average 2 to 4 hours a day to fetch water. And you're typically paying a premium of between 7 and 15 times per liter what you would pay for water if you had tap in your home. So even though the irony is what you're lacking is access to water, the water at the end of the day isn't the problem. You know where the water is. You can point to the main. The problem is this bottleneck around access to finance. So if you could actually get a loan for $100 or $200 and have the ability to pay it back over, let's say, a year, paying interest so it's sustainable and, you know, the microfinance institutions making money, that this becomes such a powerful tool for your family, and the ripple effects are enormous. Even if nothing else in your life or livelihood changes other than you get 2 to 4 hours a day back and your water bill drops by 90% overnight, people always ask me, well, how can people repay this loan? It becomes very easy to do the calculus about how they repay that loan. And you come to realize then, and with access to water in their home, that leads to improved health, that leads to improved sanitation, that saves more sort of ripple effects of time, in terms of time it takes to cook and to bathe and all of that. Usually in a family, if there's anybody that has to be allocated or assigned to be the water fetcher, it's the girl.
Yep.
And she's typically not in school. All of a sudden, she's in school, and, you know, you go on and on. So that's kind of a nutshell of where the intersection is. But what's interesting is that, as far as we're aware, there are no microfinance institutions that are offering loans for water and sanitation other than those microfinance institutions that have worked with water.org. So it's a pretty exciting initiative. It's not a silver bullet, but it's a highly effective tool where microfinance sectors are robust.
What I hear about it, as you said, is that you were always looking for places to cross-pollinate differently, is that as most of us think about microloans, they're for small businesses, the weaving business, the this, the that. But this is something which is not a business, does not have its own financial return, and yet, as you point out, the financial difference it makes to that family, to that town, that village, and through the education of those girls to that whole country can be enormous.
Exactly. And really there, I'll just wrap up by saying the reason why we don't see more loans like this typically is that if you're the microfinance institution, you want to know where the cash flow is that's going to repay your loan. So you think about micro enterprise. We're going to give you a loan for a business. Your business is going to generate income. That income is going to repay the loan. So it's pretty straightforward. In the case of water and sanitation, because we also, Water Credit also makes loans for things like toilets and, you know, sanitation solutions, they're saying, you know, where's the money coming from to pay that back? And so they see it as riskier.
Right.
But when you really scratch beneath the surface, what you find is that this is a highly income-enhancing loan. And like I explained, it's not about just looking at the basic economics of the family. You can identify quite quickly where the money comes from. And then the nice thing is that there's additional cost savings from improved health care and the fact that you know, children are in school, but then also what you find is that people who don't have access to water typically get sick much, much more often, and those are days they can't work.
Right.
So they're actually more productive.
Right. One thing I hear that's sort of a metaphor or similar is that notion of power companies are used to looking only at the money they can charge for the power they deliver, and it takes changing the laws and changing the system to allow them to make money from efficiency and from power that's not used. And it seems here we've got a similar thing. People can see money that's earned, okay, I can see that, versus money that's saved is harder to see.
Exactly. And that's actually a great segue over to the sharing economy. So what's interesting is while I was doing water credit, and that was all fine and well, I also began getting interested in the sharing economy, in part because I live in San Francisco, and it's one of the hotbeds of sharing economy activity. And so I can find, you know, car sharing, and I can find Airbnb, and I can find all of these different ways to tap into and share assets that really I was unable to prior to the internet and platforms and companies to enable us to do this. But this is where it gets really interesting. And I put back my lawyer hat, harking back to my microfinance days of advising governments around how to build financial sector infrastructure to promote microfinance, and to your case around energy companies, you know, what do we do when laws just aren't written in a way that allow us to achieve our full potential, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
And started seeing huge parallels unfolding. And I've begun saying, a bit of an overstatement, but I've begun saying that from a legal and regulatory perspective, the sharing economy and collaborative consumption as a whole today is really where microfinance was about 10 or 15 years ago. And what I mean by that is that we have built a legal and regulatory structure, not just the United States, but many countries around the world. We've built it around an ownership-based society. So we know how the law works when I sell you something. We know that you have, you know, you own the thing, you're liable for it, and I have the money, for example. But if we were to think about putting an item into shared use, that is, you know, more economically efficient, more environmentally sustainable, and has a good social value or social return as well, the law just doesn't know what to do. And so you find this huge gray area in terms of either, you know, in certain cases, activities that by no account should be illegal, if you will, look like they might be illegal, which just may, it's nonsensical to anybody. But more often what you have is a situation in which the law doesn't say that any kind of sharing behavior is legal, but it doesn't say that it's illegal either. So you're just kind of looking at it going, we could do a lot better than this. We need to be looking at how to develop, in effect, a parallel and complementary set of rules that governs sharing-based transactions. Because at the end of the day, I don't think anyone's looking to shirk the law, and no one is saying that, you know, a car that's in shared use shouldn't be regulated at all. It's important when a car goes on the road that there are, you know, rules that govern how we deal with it and how we insure it and things like that. But there's really just no catchers in it right now. Seeing the system that we've built, it's just clumsy. It's not bad. And I joke, I have no problems with the laws as they're drafted today when we apply them to an ownership situation. They were built pretty well. But when you apply, it's kind of like applying an apples to oranges analogy. The laws just fall flat.
Let me tell people that this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with April Rinne. She is the chief strategy officer for the Collaborative Lab. And we're talking about the growing trend of sharing rather than buying. And it goes under, you know, sort of formal names of collaborative consumption, the sharing economy, the peer-to-peer economy. But basically, it's a movement which has been bubbling up over the last few years and is reaching a kind of a critical mass, I'd say, at this point. As I pointed out in the introduction, articles, big articles in The Economist, in Forbes, and when they sit up and take notice, something's happening that involves a lot of people and a lot of money. You can learn more at shareable.net or collaborativeconsumption.com. Let me ask you, what you did in a way when you started talking about the legal issues and the problems and the obstacles is kind of went to a later part of the interview, if you will, because first, for some people, we want to establish what's going on here, what's happening, how big it is, how much it's growing, those sorts of things. So if you could, you know, when you told your own path, you sort of said, I was interested in this as a child, and this led me to this, and this led me to this, and so on. I'm wondering if you could tell a bit of a narrative about sharing. I mean, it's not new. It used to be much more common in small towns or villages. So sharing decreased at a time, I certainly think of the post-World War II era in the United States and then spreading throughout the globe, in a time of consumer culture, planned obsolescence, those sorts of things. And then how do you trace its reemergence? And I'm thinking, when I look for reasons, one is economic hardship. The crash of 2007, which still, as we know, is still a recession for the vast majority of people in this country and an awful lot of people around the world, even though the stock market is over 15,000 or bumping around 15,000. So economics, then it's the fact that we have young people emerging from college having trouble getting jobs, having lots of debt. And then we have new tools and social networks. So if you will sort of weave those things, because I'm sure you've thought about this, how did this reemergence start and grow?
Sure. That is a great question and a story and a journey I'm happy to take. So you're absolutely right. I mean, when we think about the course of humanity, sharing is one of the most natural and longstanding behaviors known to mankind. We are born to share. And somewhere along the path, really in the last 80 years or so, maybe back to the Industrial Revolution, but really the last 80 years, has been this era of mass consumption, mass marketing, a one person, one unit, one purchase, must have, must own it, must upgrade kind of society. We've heard it called the disposable society. We've heard, you know, different kinds of terms. But there was a long period in which everyone thought, gosh, you know, we were really, brand marketing firms really got good at telling us that the way to be happy was to have more stuff, and that more meant more stuff meant more happiness. And I think there's been a collective recognition in the last decade or so that that's really not the case. And, that's been highlighted in turn by things like the economic crises and so forth. But when we think about the sharing evolution, if you will, in recent times, I would really break it down probably into different phases. And so, and really four phases, beginning with the birth of the internet, because I think that's where it really gets started. And that's where, to your point, we're linking together the role of technology to create markets for things that didn't have a market before, but to enable us to connect with one another in ways that previously simply were not possible. So I do think that one important milestone is looking at, like, okay, the internet comes into being. What happens after that? And what happens between then and today in terms of the ways and things that we are sharing? So in that first phase, it was basically about getting everyone online. This was when the internet was born. We had the first web pages. And very early stages when it became possible to share information. So we started sharing things like knowledge and code, really simple bits of data. Then with everyone individually online, the next natural step was that these people wanted to be connected. So this was when we realized that we could connect directly with one another through things like email and early chat programs. Later on, this led to the birth of social networks like MySpace or LinkedIn, and then, of course, later by Facebook. Then now, or I should say now, you know, with people connected through these social networks, the next natural step is that they want to share more. So then we started sharing things in the online world, like multimedia, videos, music, daily thoughts, news content, stuff like that. And this gave rise to companies like YouTube and Twitter. And now what we find ourselves in today is really the, not final, but the fourth phase. I think there actually are many more future phases, but right now
right.
We're in this fourth phase in which we've seen at an accelerated rate that we can use this same technology that allowed us to share stuff online to also share stuff offline. And our entire generations growing up today, your point about the millennials, these new generations growing up that have completely different attitudes towards sharing because they've always had these technologies available. So the idea of sharing other assets, whether it's cars, space, or material possessions, skills, or time, it makes total sense.
Right. And this notion, and this notion that they found, I guess, earliest, we saw it with just posts and then music and then video and so on, was that why go through some sort of middleman? We can do this ourselves. And so I have a feeling that's the viewpoint that you look and you go, well, how can I just do this with my friends? And so, as you say, for them to say, so let's do it with cars and apartments and houses and drills and stuff is pretty natural. And I think one thing that probably is interesting is that this whole phenomenon, my guess is, looks different to someone 40 or 50 or 60. Even if it looks wonderful, my guess is it looks or feels different than it does to someone who's grown up, who's in their 20s, let's say, and has grown up with a shareable perspective on the world.
Exactly. And a couple interesting points there. So millennials, if you will, get this instinctively. They've always known life with a smartphone, right? And what's very interesting, this is a bit of a factoid, but there was a survey conducted recently among 18 to 24-year-olds. And the question was, which would you rather own, a car or a smartphone? And if you think about that, I mean, just an economic perspective, you would opt for the car. It's worth more.
Mm-hmm.
75% of the people surveyed said they would opt for a smartphone because they know that the smartphone can help them get the car. And they don't need to own the car. They just need to access it. And not just the car, but a lot of other stuff. So millennials get it instinctively. My grandparents also instinctively get this.
Mm.
They just joke with me in terms of, like, listen, we grew up sharing. This is, we grew up on a farm. We constantly were in touch with our community, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to map the people that have the hardest time with sharing, you can literally almost do a line-for-line mapping exercise with those people born during those years of mass consumption. Those people born and socialized to believe that we lived in an ownership society, owning more was a good thing, owning more led to happiness, and sharing was just not something that was culturally recognized.
Yeah. No, so you're saying basically the baby boomers.
The baby boomers have the hardest time of all.
It's interesting.
So we've kind of missed a generation and a half or so in there.
Yeah.
But what makes me excited is it's not like we have to learn some kind of new behavior. We are ingrained to share. We have been socialized for a half a century to do things a different way. But when you look at the course of human history,
right,
that actually looks more like the anomaly.
Of course. That's...
Sharing looks like the norm.
Right. And there was a period where, and believe me, I sit right in the middle of that that baby boomer generation, when it was, this is how it is now and shall always be. You know, this is how it is now and this is progress. You know, this is the way we all, everything led to this. And it turns out now, only a few decades later, that as you point out, that was the anomaly, that was the blip, and the environment would have forced this realization on us sooner or later. But it is interesting how, as we've been talking throughout this conversation, how different threads come together to produce change. We're at about the halfway mark. I want to tell people that you're listening to Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with April Rinna. We're talking about this growing trend of sharing rather than buying. And you can learn more at shareable1word.net or collaborativeconsumption1word.com. Okay, so we've set this up. Let me ask just a couple more questions about where we are now. How big is this in terms of scale, money, whatever? A couple of things that'll give people a sense of the scale.
Sure. Well, it's growing quite quickly, as the Forbes and Economist articles have mentioned. Sharing economy companies are growing. Many of them are growing at sort of breakneck pace, 25%, 40%. Airbnb, as of roughly, I mean, the numbers are going up every day. They have booked more than 10 million nights around the world at this point. Now, the majority of those nights were actually booked in 2012. So we're looking at a case in which, since 2010 more or less, We have seen just a real uptick across the board. So when we look at the number of companies out there, when we look at the amount of investment capital and venture capital, everything, and we look at the number of companies launching in different countries, across the board, we're just seeing growth, very robust growth. But one thing I also want to highlight at some point in this conversation, and I might as well mention it now, is that what gets a lot of press is the, I guess what you could say, it's the Airbnb phenomenon. And I'm a huge fan of Airbnb and Couchsurfing and a whole lot of, you know, shared space platforms. But the companies that are getting the venture capital are really the ones that are showing up in the magazines and on the headlines and so forth. And that's all fine and well. But there's an entire value spectrum that we want to look at here. And what I mean by that is that a lot of these sharing companies, you're paying money in some way, shape, or form to get access to the good or service. So Airbnb, it's monetizable. Car sharing platforms, they're monetizable. That's great. They're still more economically efficient. They enable a more diverse set of experiences, better for the environment, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also this other part of the value spectrum, what I would term the non-monetizable part of the spectrum, where goods and services are being exchanged, value is being created, but money is not necessarily changing hands. And there's growth, huge growth in that space as well. And it might be easy to just point to one comparison. People often ask me, you know, which is better, Couchsurfing or Airbnb? And that's really not the best.
Now, by the way, not all listeners know what either of them are or do. So let's say Couchsurfing is where you put up that you are willing to have people sleep on your couch. In other words, you're not even renting them a room. You are just saying, you can come and stay with me. And by the same token, the customer is someone who says, I'm willing to get by without a room. I want to be in Amsterdam for 2 days in August, and I'm just going to find someone's couch to stay on. And is Couchsurfing free?
Yes.
Okay, so Couchsurfing is one that is not monetized. Airbnb, again, people don't necessarily know about it. Airbnb is a website you go to, and you can say, again, I'm going to be in Amsterdam for 2 days in August. You can look for someone who wants to rent you an apartment, a room in their apartment, that sort of thing, and that one is for money. But the advantage there is, A, that it's going to be less than a competing hotel or anything like that, and that also there's the sense of an Airbnb renter that they are more to you than a landlord. They are going to help introduce you to their neighborhood or their community. Is that pretty good?
That's pretty good. Let me add a little bit more color.
Sure. Go right ahead.
So in terms of couch surfing, even though it's called couch surfing, I mean, you might end up staying on a couch. That's absolutely true. You might also end up getting your own room and, you know, the whole bit. So it's the point about couch surfing is that it's based on reciprocity and it is free. So if what really matters to you is that you want to travel on the cheap and meet interesting people, then you sign up for Couchsurfing. Wherever you go on Couchsurfing, you're going to stay for free. The expectation in turn is that when you are home and other Couchsurfers reach out to you and ask to stay with you, that you will oblige, that you will, to the extent that you're able, host people as well as be a Couchsurfer. So give and get. But no money exchanges hands. In the case of Airbnb, money is exchanging hands. You know, you're paying a given rate, and Airbnb is taking a small commission from that to facilitate the transaction. You have an inventory of everything from a tiny room in a house where the people are there to a castle or a treehouse or all kinds of things where the people aren't even there. So you're looking at a place as a situation. Pay money for value. You may or may not meet your host. If you do, they typically will be wonderful local residents and enthusiasts about where they live, and you can see more local neighborhoods and so forth. But you're also assured of getting a certain standard of quality, if you will. So if it's more important to you, you've got some money to spend, and it's more important that you either have your own room or have a place that has you know, that you're going to have to yourself and can be assured of the quality and assured it's quiet and things like that, then you would opt for Airbnb. And I think for me, the main point is both companies, both platforms provide a whole lot of value. Which one is better really depends on what your priorities are in traveling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me also share with people that if this is new to you and you're thinking your certain concerns are coming up, let me remind you of two things which handle, I think, two of the major concerns, and they are two of the other phenomena the internet has brought us. One is reviews. Whether it's TripAdvisor, Yelp, etc., we are now, it is possible to get reviews of the restaurant, the hotel, the nightclub, you name it. Well, that is what works in both of these, or in most of these platforms as well, is that you say, well, I'm going to stay with someone that I've never, you know, in another country and so on. All I know is that they're online. Well, no, people will review them. The second thing that happens is we also now can find people that may very well be related to people we know in our social networks. And so there's that other level beyond the specific review is the notion that, oh, this person is, it turns out, is a friend of a friend of a friend that you would never have known, but now you can see that because you may both be on Facebook. Or you can see, oh, I'm going to go to their Facebook page, see what their interests are, see what their employment is, see those sorts of things. And so there are ways now to very simply get the kind of information to allay your concerns in a way that just was not possible 10 years ago.
Right. And really what you're talking about there is the underlying factor, component, driver, whatever you want to call it, of trust. How can we trust that these platforms are reliable and safe, et cetera, et cetera? And so even before we get to the point of doing reviews, in the first instance, it's how do I know that this person is for real? And so Airbnb, all of these platforms have a very robust system of verification so that we know that the people who are posting rooms up there, posting, you know, services on TaskRabbit or whatever, that they're bona fide people that are going to provide the product or services in question. And so there are multiple levels in which these companies do the sort of upfront verification. And then you have the experience, you share the thing, you go to that place, whatever, and then you can provide reviews after the fact. But really what we're talking about is how can we trust one another in this system that has been built by and large for, we've constructed a lot of our models these days on a default of distrust, and we're trying to also reimagine what does it mean to build a company based on trust, not naive trust or blind trust, but responsible trust that helps us create markets for things that didn't have markets before and help us reimagine how we can transact with one another again and create value and create wealth. So, you know, the two key drivers that we talk about in the sharing economy are trust and efficiency. And that really speaks to what you were talking about slightly earlier around disintermediation. The sharing economy enabled people to get rid of the middlemen, which is economically efficient. Again, good for the environment, good for society. But when we match those two drivers of trust and efficiency, really get just a blossoming of the kinds of platforms that can succeed in this space.
Okay, very good. That's the voice of April Rennie. She is with collaborativeconsumption.com and the Collaborative Lab, and we're talking about sharing. April, I'm going to read a couple of the things that I found as I was researching this, just so these are not going to be questions. It's just going to be some things that are going on, and then when I'm finished, you can comment on them. One is, this is in the realm of car sharing. So this is, again, this is monetized, but it is sharing. And listen to this. The car sharing unit of the rental car company Hertz, okay, so Hertz, we know them as rental cars, is expanding in the coming months. It's called Hertz 24/7. It will extend its car sharing model that had been available in urban areas and college campuses, which makes sense, that's where it would start, in the U.S. and in five other countries, to suburban and rural areas. It will improve ease of use with self-service features, including keyless entry and a flexible rental term, And it says the rollout will eventually provide service to the vast majority of Americans. It's going to begin in late summer in the U.S. and followed soon after in Europe and later in China. So this is the big boys, Hertz, if you will, the biggest boys of the rental car company, now doubling down on their interest in car sharing. Now, another article I found that was very interesting was about what's going on in Spain. And April, I don't know if you're aware of this, but as people who followed the European crisis, debt crisis, have know, Spain has taken a very hard hit in this recession. According to the Spanish government, more than 500,000 families have no income, no income at all. The unemployment rate has climbed to 26%. 26, that's one in four. But among young workers, it is an astonishing 55%. So what has happened? How have they coped with this? Well, it turns out, again, the timing and the technologies and the possibilities were there. Barter is up. Nearly 100 bartering markets have appeared in Catalonia alone. The number of time banks in Spain has doubled in the past 3 years. Time banks are where you can exchange your time for someone's time with no money changing hands. I will watch your pet. You will help me with a software problem. I will help a senior. You will, you know, help me with a construction problem. Time banking, and the other cool thing about most time banks is that each hour is worth the same. In other words, a lawyer or a financier's time is not worth more than a young person or a senior. So the number of time banks in Spain has doubled in the past 3 years. Socialcar.com allows people to rent their private cars to other individuals, while JoinUp Taxi makes it easy for people to share taxis to the same destination. Nolotiro.org, which means I won't throw it out, allows people to give away things they don't need anymore, such as clothing or tools. Mi Huerto Compartido, my shared garden, allows landowners to lend ground in exchange for part of the harvest. And Truque Book, AES, users barter school books and other goods for children. So this is, I mean, if you think this is a San Francisco phenomenon or American phenomenon, hardly. This, the time is right for this to happen all over the world. Any thoughts?
Absolutely. So I'll take those in turn. And I know that thus far we've been really focusing on the role of the startups or the collaborative consumption companies that really began as such. So the Airbnbs and the Zipcars and so forth. What we haven't talked much about, though, are the big players, established companies, incumbents, whatever you want to call it. I get really excited about this. And at Collaborative Lab, we actually work with startups and entrepreneurs and collaborative consumption companies. We also work with established companies, and we also work with governments, again, around the policy space. So when you look at big companies, I think on one hand, of course, it helps to validate the fact that there are certain demographic trends afoot. I do believe, though, that some companies, incumbent companies, that see their current model built strictly on an ownership, you know, buy more stuff, built in that way of thinking, do feel in some ways, I would term it a combination of threatened and curious. And so we're actually seeing, not as much as we'd like to, but we are seeing some meaningful innovation by established companies to get into this space. Because they recognize that when they look on the horizon and they think about the changing demographics, and they recognize that millennials are making it very clear that they do not want to own so much stuff. They're not aspiring to home and car ownership. They're aspiring to having rich lives that are rich in experience and flexibility and access to things. And they're realizing that they need to figure that out, and they need to develop, keep abreast of their clientele, and innovate in terms of their overall offerings. So we're seeing an enormous amount of innovation, for example, among car manufacturers. Not just Hertz, but BMW and Daimler and General Motors did a partnership with a car-sharing company called Relay Rides. They made an investment in them. Also are partnering together with their technology for their online dashboard so that Relay Rides customers can actually benefit from GM technology. GM, meanwhile, can learn about the behavior patterns of car sharers, and who knows, perhaps someday develop, design a fleet of cars specifically to be shared. So this is all really exciting stuff. You know, Walmart is also, even Walmart has developed a white label delivery service that's about enabling you to go and pick up the pack of the purchases of your neighbors, and you maybe get a small fee for that. And it's creating community within Walmart, and it's not necessarily meaning that everyone has to go to the store all the time. There are all kinds of these examples happening, so I get very encouraged by that. I think it's part of a much broader shift amongst big business, recognizing that the ways of the mass consumption and production era in terms of just buy more stuff, that is no longer going to work so well for a variety of different reasons. One is we're recognizing that more stuff doesn't necessarily make somebody happier, but also to the point that you alluded to, we are living now in a world where we are much more aware of resource shortages or scarcity of natural resources and the fact that we live on a finite planet in a much more sophisticated and attuned way than during the era of mass consumption, where the idea of just pillaging or plundering the Earth's resources just wasn't the same as it is today. And we also didn't have, you know, climate change at 400 parts per billion. So,
right. By the way, one of the things I think one should always remember, and it certainly comes into play here, when one thinks about resources running out, is also disposal space running out. And so we can't just keep pulling things out to keep making stuff, but two, we run out of room to store stuff, to throw away our trash. And this, of course, this idea of reuse and recycle and stuff moving around rather than becoming obsolete is a big piece there. Let me ask you, I'm going to ask you basically, we've got about 7 minutes. I'm going to ask you three questions. The first one goes back to what you were talking about with legal issues in a way. Is this all as innocent and socially positive as it sounds at first? For instance, with apartment sharing, the most prominent entity being Airbnb. What about the issues of legality and taxes? And can't this strategy be used by unscrupulous landlords to get around rent control? So what are some of the problems and what are some solutions? Let me, if you can take like just a minute or two to kind of give people a sense of that.
Sure. Well, looking specifically at sharing of space, or I guess I should back up and say taxation is one of those uber overarching issues that affects a lot of sharing economy companies. And the question really there is, what's taxable activity and what's not? And at what point does a casual car share or somebody that rents a room on Airbnb literally to help make ends meet, which is what a lot of people are doing, at what point does that person become a small business? There's a big difference between somebody who rents a room on Airbnb every now and again, somebody that owns 10 properties and has them all listed on Airbnb and is running an effective bed and breakfast. So big issues are surrounding that. And I think there are lots of ways we can look at slicing and dicing that issue, I suppose you could say. And this is not an insurmountable obstacle. I mean, taxation, you can just think about recent tax issues that Amazon has faced when it has factories in certain states but not others, and people just want to figure out who to tax what and when and where and how. It's a different variation of that.
Well, and one thing I learned in researching this is actually that when you share something, it usually is not taxed, but barter is taxable. I'm sure that's news to some people, but so this would be just kind of, you know, the next step in that, right? I mean, that you can collect taxes on something that doesn't look conventionally like a business.
You can, but the question remains. I mean, what you really want to look at, and tax lawyers will always talk about form versus substance. You want to look at the substance of the transaction, and you want to look at, you know, what are the motivations and the incentives for people to engage in this kind of behavior. Because the flip side is, and, you know, backing up again, looking at the macro picture, the sharing economy as a whole does lead to significant job creation and investment in local communities. So when you think about staying at Airbnb, for instance, you're especially in our local community, the money you're giving is staying right there where you're based, versus staying in a hotel, at least if it's an international hotel chain, that money is leaving the community. So if you're a city leader, you kind of like things that bring money and bring money that stays in your community. At the same time, you're aware that you need to keep up your tax base. So you're doing a little bit of a calculus in terms of, I want to tax activities in a way that still leads to local economic investment and doesn't lead people to stop doing this activity altogether. So there's kind of a sliding scale that you look at there where you're balancing how much local economic investment can we get and what's a reasonable way to tax this, because we do know, too, that at a certain level, if taxes by the Airbnb community were deemed to be, you know, inappropriate or whatever, people would just stop engaging in some of this behavior, or they would take it offline and they would not no longer do it necessarily on Airbnb, but they could actually do it in a way that was less regulated and therefore arguably more challenging and potentially more problematic.
Right. So, in other words, one of the things that Airbnb supplies for its commission is it does supply an insurance policy mm-hmm. in case things happen and so on. And so what you're saying is, okay, so we start picking on the big boys, and now it ends up with, you know, people perhaps that are less trustworthy or less user-friendly.
Well, I think the irony is that going back to that evolution of the sharing economy and how we've been able to use technology sharing one another in novel ways, when Airbnb launched, it was very, very novel. There are now hundreds right. of platforms around the world where you can share your space. Now, the interesting thing is once you've participated in those platforms, you know how to connect with people. And how do I say this? I mean, I don't want to say that you would just take it all offline, but there are now tools available.
Where you can.
Available.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you can do things in a less transparent way that arguably is not as good as what the company is providing. And so the company really needs to be treated as what it is, which is a small but growing company that's entering this new and innovative part of the marketplace, but that is, it's equally valid, but it's not an apples-to-apples comparison to a hotel, for instance.
Right. Very good. The more that I spend time with young people, the more I get the feeling that some of the questions, visions, and values that emerged in the 60s are reemerging. A commitment to community and justice, expanding civil rights, sharing, not so much commercial, you know, conspicuous consumption, believing change is possible, go on and on. First, do you agree about that emergence or reemergence of some of those values and perspectives? And second, if you do, does anything about the way that it's occurring now give you hope that some of these cultural and value changes may survive and flourish better than they did in the 60s?
Great question. Well, I wasn't around in the 60s, but I've heard stories. And I do think that by and large, we are seeing a reemergence or a reiteration of those shared principles on community. I think really that people are recognizing that it's not all about money, and that we've built a kind of binary system where we measure things by the amount of dollars in your savings account or the amount of dollars in the stock market, and that's a sort of, we allow ourselves to be dictated by the trend in the market. Whereas I think that, I think often of a friend of mine, her name is Jessica Jackley. She was the co-founder of Kiva.org, if you're mm-hmm. familiar with Kiva.
Yeah.
She has this quote that I have just started repeating all over the place. She says, I want to build a life that is rich in the currencies that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that really summarizes what I think is going on at a very broad level. We're recognizing that, okay, fair enough, the dollar is one currency, but it's a pretty clumsy and binary currency, and it's good for some things. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that I can do and experience and enjoy and contribute and have and do and all the rest that doesn't revolve around a dollar bill. And so I think there is a growing understanding of what's possible, but what we haven't yet done is that transition to a world in which we're able to measure and track and acknowledge, I guess you could say, this broader set of value drivers.
Okay, we got to wrap it up there. So again, we've been talking about the growing trend of sharing rather than buying, and it's more formally known as collaborative consumption or the sharing or peer-to-peer economy, and you can learn more at shareable.net or collaborativeconsumption.com. Thank you, April Rinna. Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, Terrence. It's been a pleasure.
For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and so on, or to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com near the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at my site or at iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, and to Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.